Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to Toy Harp, a podcast about bluegrass. This is the last episode of season two. Here from Nashville is my conversation with Allison Krauss.
I remember, you know, the first time I looked out in the audience and saw people singing words to our songs that only we had recorded. That was just a really crazy moment. Just never thought it'd end up being there. Never thought we'd hear back from Rounder. Yeah. Never thought we would hear from Rounder in the first place.
If this is your first time listening, you can hear full interviews with Jerry Douglas, Allison Brown, Bela Fleck, Larry Sparks, Jody Stecker, and so many more wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Later on.
Welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians. It's Cindy and Lizzie.
For those who might not know, I came to Cindy's house while she was not there, and Cindy's wonderful wife, Hootie, aka Elizabeth, hosted me, and so I was just the stand-in Cindy. I recorded a podcast. I did all the Cindy things, but I did not kiss your wife.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Boundaries.
Thank you for being upfront about that.
She's very wonderful. Anyone would be lucky to smooch her, but she is your wife and not mine.
Our first podcast together in 2023.
Happy New Year, bud. Ooh,
I've had some conversations with people recently. So we have a new puppy and it's a girl. And we call her Bud. Like, her name is Puddles, but she's got like tons of nicknames.
Of course.
And one of them is Bud. Like, come here, Bud. And both of our moms have been like, why do you call your girl dog Bud?
Yes, Bud is coded male, and I just refuse to accept that. As if friendship is for men. It's not. It's for all of us.
I also have a girl cat, and I never call her Bud. And the other day, because I've been calling the puppy Bud so much, I called her Bud. It felt strange, but then I was like, I'm going to work through this.
Okay, but you're my Bud, Cindy.
You're also my Bud.
Love it.
Hey, Bud.
Hey, Bud. And hey, Bud, you, our listener.
It's 2023. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. We're a listener-supported operation. You can make a contribution. Get a beanie. Basicfolk.com. And you can find your beanie there and support us. It's wintertime. You need one. You can also sign up for our newsletter at our website. Today we have an exciting guest.
We really do.
That we learned how to pronounce his name recently. Anthony D'Amato.
That's true.
Is his name?
He told us that if you're in Italy, they probably say D'Amato, but he says D'Amato so that people can know how to spell it and know how to find it.
Before we get into Anthony, Lizzie, is there anything you want to update us on?
Yeah.
What's going on with you?
I think by the time people are listening to this, I will be on my way to the UK, England, and Scotland, and Northern Ireland. I've never played over there. I've never performed over there. I will be at Americana Fest UK and Celtic Connections and the Out to Lunch Festival. I'm so excited. And then I'm going to the West Coast of the US of A. People can look at lizzieknow.com for those tour dates. I have really been looking forward to headlining on the West Coast. I feel like it's been building for many years. It's a place I love so much. And I'm bringing John Calvin Abney, Basic Folk alum, and Nelson Williams, who's a wonderful bass player. So people are going to really love those shows.
Should we talk about our guest today?
Yeah, I would love to.
Anthony D'Amato.
Anthony D'Amato is a friend of mine, which I always feel like I have to declare at the top of the podcast so people won't be like, oh, she spoke so highly of this person, and then later I found out they were friends. It's crooked.
Deception.
It's crooked all the way to the top. Yeah, I'm friends with this man. I admire him, okay? But I admired him before we were friends. So maybe that's important to say. I don't know. That was my journalistic disclosure. So when I first moved to New York City in 2015... with hopes of becoming a superstar singer-songwriter, I needed some advice, and I needed to find people who were doing it well and sustainably and were having some success. And Anthony D'Amato was crushing it. He was just like so professional. He was fresh off of his New West Records debut, The Shipwreck from the Shore. He was touring, putting out great music, and he was kind enough to take me out for coffee and give me some advice about how to turn this dream into a job. And it meant everything to me at the time, and it still does. I look back at that time, and there must have been tons of people asking him, like, how'd you do it? And he was so generous in sharing, like, how do you, you know, elevate your craft? How do you find a good manager? All of these, like, practical aspects of being a songwriter that are a little bit harder to break down than, like, you know, do I want to do it? So 7 years later, it was so nice to kind of come full circle and bookend that early conversation with an in-depth Basic Folk interview with Anthony. He has a new album out. It's called At First There Was Nothing. It's his first new album in 6 years, and it showcases so much of what makes Anthony special as an artist. Neat wordplay, a sophisticated visual language that's bolstered by his skills as a wildlife photographer. And he has these signature production things that I've always noticed in his albums, like across all of his work for years and years. There's like a signature Anthony sound, and I was really eager to dig into that. So we investigated what those signatures are in our interview. The album is produced by another folk rock singer-songwriter star, Joshua James. And it's a really gorgeous album that was produced in American Fork, Utah. And you can kind of hear the West in this new album. If you listen all the way through to the end, to the lightning round, you will hear me get into a fight on air with my friend Anthony, because there would be no folk music without bloodshed. I think people are really, really going to enjoy this new album. It's getting a lot of praise from places like American Songwriter. This is my conversation with Anthony D'Amato.
Cool. Let's check out a song from Anthony's new album. He must have a thing about ships.
Yeah.
Because this song is called Ships in the Night. And then we'll hear Lizzie Know and Anthony D'Amato on Basic Folk.
Welcome to Basic Folk.
Thank you for
having
me.
For the very first time. It's shocking. It's novel.
Yeah.
It's totally surprising. Everything's so surprising.
I can't imagine.
Where are you right now?
I am in the Econo Lodge in Sturbridge, Massachusetts.
Oh, wow.
Just a place I like to hang out, you know, collect my thoughts, have a little me time.
I mean, who among us hasn't really felt the urge to unwind at the Econo Lodge?
Specifically the one in Sturbridge, Massachusetts, though.
Yes, yes. That's the top one.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take it way back to the beginning of your life. We've got a lot of questions.
Yeah, fire away.
How far back does your connection to animals go? Like, what is your earliest memory of, like, being around a non-human animal and being like, that's my friend?
We had animals growing up all the time in the house when I was a kid. And I think probably, funnily enough, the earliest ones that I remember are cats that I think my parents had before I was born. and didn't live too much longer after that. So I didn't have like a super tight connection with them, but I do remember there being cats around the house. And then when I got a little bit older, that was when we kind of started getting pets that were like the kids' pets, you know? So we got a dog.
Oh, really? What were those?
We had a dog named Screwball, who was, she was a Dalmatian. She was a rescue dog from Puerto Rico who'd been hit by a car and brought back to the States. And she was amazing. She was part Dalmatian, part Whippet. So she kind of looked like a greyhound, but she had spots and like one black ear and one black eye. Laziest dog ever. All she wanted to do was just sleep and lay around. But the way that you could tell she was truly a D'Amato dog was that she got very car sick. Anytime she had to go for a drive, she would like start to drool and throw up in the back seat. So we had to bring like a plastic bag and catch her puke and throw it out every time we went to a rest stop. But
it got to the point
that when you pulled the car around to the front of the house and she saw that it was like time to go somewhere, she would just start drooling and puking in the front yard. And that's how you know she was my dog, because her anxiety was to the point that the mere sight of the thing that made her sick itself made her sick.
Which is so efficient, actually.
It did not get rid of all of, I should clarify.
Oh, no.
It wasn't like she got this out of the way.
She just started early.
It just started early.
I take back what I said.
Yeah.
Oh, poor Screwball.
She was
Who can relate, though? I can relate.
Yeah.
I can relate.
I do that now. I'll be on tour and I'll see something that like, oh, I know that's going to be stressful later. And then, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm in that moment, even though it hasn't even started
You bring the stress home within before the stimulus even comes near you.
Right, which just makes things that much worse. But, you know, we're simple creatures, you know.
And have you always been imaginative in other ways? Or was it just anxiety? Or did you create, like, imagined worlds in your mind as a kid?
Oh, yeah, I definitely did that. They were probably anxious worlds. But I did create a lot of worlds in my head for sure. And, you know, I think it's probably like an escapism sort of thing for me, as it is for most people. Just the, you know, if you're someplace that you're not like super psyched on being in the moment, you're like, well, how could this be more interesting?
Sometimes people call that like a maladaptive coping mechanism if it goes too far. But it sounds like you keep it in control, because you're a well-adjusted adult, wouldn't you say?
I don't feel like that's for me to say.
Okay.
I will let the other people in my life decide if I'm a well-adjusted adult. Both parts of that phrase, well-adjusted and adult, I think can be called into question.
Yeah. Okay, so you grew up in New Jersey, just like I did.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is like the most New Jersey thing about you?
That I've seen Bruce Springsteen like 54 times.
Really?
Something crazy like that, yeah. It's up there.
That's a lot of times.
It's a lot of time. It is. It's a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to go again on this tour.
How has Bruce's show changed since, like, the first time you saw him? Like, what was your first experience seeing Bruce
My first live? Experience seeing him live, I guess, was probably the, like, E Street Band reunion tours in, like, 99. So...
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was pretty young then. Still, I was probably, I guess I would have been like 12. And I knew the music because, you know, it was kind of just always being played in our mm-hmm. home. But I wasn't like familiar enough with it to be like, oh man, he's playing a deep cut now. Or, you know, like that kind of, like I didn't know what to get super excited about. I was just like, this is the biggest, most intense show I've ever seen. And it's awesome. In terms of how it's changed over the years, that's a good question. I mean, they lost Clarence, they lost Danny. I feel like it's become a bit more of like, trying to think how to say this. I think it's more of a team effort now than it's ever been. I think, you know, with the loss of Clarence, they started bringing in like a whole horn section, you know, to replace, because you can't replace that guy.
Right.
But so do something different. You bring in a whole horn section. And you know, and some more backup singers and that. So it does kind of feel like it's kind of more of like a family or a group thing now, mm-hmm. rather than like the Bruce Springsteen show, which I hesitate to say that, because so the band has always been very important in that aspect. But I do think now that the band isn't, in quotes, the band the way it was in the early days, that I think they're finding ways to make that circle larger and bring in more guests and be more collaborative.
That's beautiful. I want to go back to when you're 12, yeah, and you see Bruce Springsteen for the first time. Were you playing music yourself at that time? Like, I'm curious what was going through your mind as you're seeing a show that huge. Did you already have thoughts in your mind of like, I'm going to do that when I grow up? Or was it something that was really far away from you?
You know, I'm trying to remember. I think I probably had started playing guitar a little bit at that point. In 1999, I would think that was, if I didn't, it was right around that time. But I do think the way that my dad had kind of tested the waters of like, would you like a guitar or would you be interested in it, was because I've been taking piano lessons since I was a kid. But I remember at one point, again, it was like a Springsteen thing that was on TV or something. It was a performance. And my dad asked me, like, does that look like fun? Is that something like you would want to do? And I was like, of course that looks like fun. It's like something everybody would want to do. And like that was, yeah, I think, the Christmas that I got a guitar. So,
wow.
You know, it does all, you ask the most New Jersey thing about me. It's that pretty much everything somehow traces back to Bruce Springsteen.
Yes, of course. So then, okay, so we're in New Jersey. We're making our, we're taking our Anthony D'Amato hero's journey. You see the big show, you're playing guitar. Okay, then you go to the fancy private school. Talk about that time. Like, I think there's, I focus on this because I too was a scholarship kid at a fancy New Jersey private school. And I do think it's a particular type of experience that gives you an awareness of yourself, and awareness of sort of earning your way in the world. So how did like that time in your life, your time at private school, kind of influence how you think about learning and think about yourself as a, you know, an achiever, a worker, a learner?
Yeah. You know, I think being a scholarship kid from a family that, you know, wasn't loaded, it was kind of a sense of, you know, every day you got to earn your keep, which is a weird, pressure to put on yourself as a, you know, 15-year-old or something. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was also the sense of like, well, this is only one step, you know, you've got to do well enough here that you can get like the real good scholarships for the real good colleges. You know, you can't come out of here and then, you know, be mediocre and have to, yeah, pay for school that we can't pay for college or whatever. So it was one of those things where it was kind of like I put a lot of pressure on myself. That was also around the time. So, like I said, I started playing guitar maybe when I was 12 or 13, and it was an electric guitar. It was like a Fender Stratocaster. And I enjoyed it, but it didn't quite click with me because I wasn't in a band. And like, yeah, solo electric Stratocaster is like not the most compelling thing when you're sitting in your room. Like, I was never like a scales.
There's a few indie artists today I think would like a word.
Yeah, I was never like a scales and solos person.
Right.
So it was when I was in high school that I got my first acoustic. And then I was like, okay, I can, and you know, and then I started playing harmonica and it's like, I can do the Bob Dylan thing. I can do the Leonard Cohen thing. I can, you know, I can play by myself. I can write the song. I can, you know, figure out how to record it. I can, everything. I can do it myself alone at home. Mm-hmm. And that became a real emotional outlet for a stressed out, anxious kid.
Yeah. You know, recording yourself, it seems like, has always been a part of your artistic output. What were some of those first recordings you made?
You know, I think the very, very first recordings would have been like, you know, my parents are out of the house, so it's empty. And I would go grab my dad's old, like, cassette recorder, you know, that he would use to, like, again, bring it back to Bruce. He would record bootleg, you know, concerts he was at.
Oh my God.
But I would use that cassette recorder and just record myself like covering songs just to see like what I sounded like, you know? Mm-hmm. So at the time it might've been like a Pete Yorn song or something, you know, that I was like really into, something that was new that had just come out. And that's kind of how I worked my guitar lessons. I love Pete Yorn. He's that first record, Music for the Morning After, was like a huge reason that I started writing songs.
Yeah. No skips on that.
Yeah.
Name a bad song on that album.
And he took me out for like my first shows and stuff. And he was super integral in all of this. So shout out to Pete Yorn for always so supportive and just a great guy. But yeah, that was probably how I started, was probably like, you know, recording Pete Yorn covers on a cassette tape, mm-hmm. and then listening back and being like, ugh, I hope nobody hears this. You know,
what was it about it that was uncomfortable?
It was my voice.
I feel like that's everybody. Nobody likes their voice at first.
Yeah. And I'd never sung. I didn't know anybody who sang, mm-hmm. that was not like, you know, I didn't come from a singing, dancing family. So I was like, you know, trying to figure it out, and I'm still trying to figure it out. But it's one of the things I feel like I've learned along the way is any voice can be good and interesting and compelling. It doesn't matter, you know, the tone or the quality or the strength of it or how they hit the notes or if they hit the notes. If you believe what they're saying, then it's great. Some of my favorite singers are not good singers by traditional standards. But man, I am locked in on every single word coming out of their mouth.
I firmly want to believe that, but it's like, I feel like I believe that about other people, but when it comes to my own recordings, I'm like, you better be in tune.
Right.
And nearly perfect.
And I've had to, that's one of the things you're talking about before, the idea of, you know, that recording myself was important to me. Mm-hmm. When I finally started letting go of that and letting other people mm-hmm. produce records, I don't know if you've had this experience when you're working with someone else, you're like, oh, I'd like to take another crack at that because my voice kind of broke in the middle of that note. And when the producer says, you're like, no, that was cool, we're keeping that. And I'm like, no, that's a mistake, I didn't mean to do that. And they're like, I don't care, it sounds cool, we're keeping it.
Yeah.
That's a really hard thing to accept, like anything less than perfection from yourself. But you have to be able to step outside of that and be like, you know, the things that I love listening to the most are not perfection. They're like humanity, you know?
Oh, it's so freeing to get there.
Yeah. But
it's so freeing to get to that place and let yourself listen to your music as someone else might listen to it.
It's so hard to do. I still don't know that I'm there, but I'm at least at a point where I can allow myself to believe it when someone else says to me, like, yeah, that was cool. You know, I'm like, okay, I believe that that was cool to you. And I believe that because that it would be cool to other people. It's not cool to me because it sounds like me messing up. But
yes,
I am going to accept that other people might enjoy that.
Speaking of collaboration, let's travel to Princeton University. Yeah. Tell us how you got into poetry.
So the funny thing there is I would hesitate to even describe myself as someone who like got really into poetry or took a lot of poetry classes and stuff, because I didn't really. I mean, I do love, you know, I love a good poem as much as the next man, mm-hmm. but I didn't set out to study poetry. What happened there was that Paul Muldoon, who I think you know as well.
Love you, Paul. Hi.
He was the head of the arts program and obviously a Pulitzer Prize winning poet. And I think he was poetry editor at the New Yorker even at the time. Mm-hmm. And but he was also really into rock and roll music. He had a band and he wrote lyrics with Warren Zevon and stuff. So I sought him out as someone who I thought could help make my songwriting better. And also because at a school like that, you know, I feel like things are changing there and elsewhere now. But at the time, it was like if you wanted to go through the music program, your choices were classical or like conducting an orchestra or the jazz ensemble. And I was like, what if you want to be a vaguely alternative folk singer? And that wasn't really, you know, believe it or not, a course of study at the time. So I went to Professor Muldoon and I just said, you know, here's what I'd like to do, like rather than for my performance credits, rather than being in the jazz ensemble, like I want to come and work on songwriting with you. And he was game. So I would, you know, every so often I would have a new batch of songs and I would bring them to him with the printed out lyrics and stuff. And he'd spend some time with them and mark them up with a red pen. And then I'd come sit with him and we'd go through the lyrics and he'd show me, you know, where something could be tighter or where, you know, this image ties in nicely to that image and in ways that I hadn't even intentionally done or thought about, but made me start thinking more intentionally about that going forward. You know, he mm-hmm. you know, in addition to showing me where, you know, perhaps my instincts had led me astray and created something that was, you know, confusing or could be cleaned up, he also helped me understand places where my instincts were good and could be built on in future stuff so that it's not just, you know, coincidence that I land in a place like that, that I could intentionally right. direct myself there.
That's kind of a trip. I did a little bit of that in college where I was like, I really want to be writing songs, but I also have all of these assignments due.
Right.
Can I twist it into a creative writing, poetry, lyrical assignment?
Yeah.
But there is something a little bit frightening about taking your personal lyrics. I always find songwriting to be such a personal project. And then, like, let's bring it to the classroom setting. Did that kind of, like, less personal type of process change how you looked at your own output?
You know, because it was just me and him, it wasn't like I was going up in front of a classroom and presenting and all that. It didn't feel like it was becoming less personal or anything. Mm-hmm. It just felt like a collaboration kind of. And I took like composition courses there too, where it was like, you know, the other students in the class, they might compose like a little classical suite or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I would come in and I would have like just a song that I wrote, and I play it on guitar and sing it, you know. And I do think maybe on some level I got desensitized to, like, I have to share this with people, otherwise I don't get credit for the class.
Yeah.
So, you know, that there wasn't the option to be that, like, oh no, I write songs, but I don't like to share them with people. You know,
right.
I couldn't be that person.
Well, that's a hell of a way to break the ice. Like, instead of going to open mics, you brought your songs to a schmancy university. That's, like, a really interesting way to, like, break out into, like, okay, here are my things. I'm sharing them. I'm inviting critique.
Yeah. And then I would, you know, I would start taking the train into New York from there and go play shows in New York at, you know, little bars and stuff like that. And so I felt like I was kind of getting, you know, both sides of the experience you need. I was getting the intellectual side of, like, let's sit down with the song and a piece of paper, you know, with the words on it and go through it a line at a time. And then I was getting, like, let's go to the loud, drunk, talkative bar and see what songs people respond to. And, you know, I feel like somewhere in between those two worlds of feedback, you can kind of figure out what's working and what's not.
Okay, so was that that's the editing and feedback process that went into Paper Backbones, I'm assuming?
Yeah, I mean, even before that, I made one collection of songs. Actually, I probably did a couple of collections of songs, like, in my dorm room at school. And just, you know, self-released those. And then I've let those all gently drift out of print as an act of mercy to myself and the universe.
But now the Basic Folk audience is aware of them and we're going to hunt them down.
They probably can be found. They're burned onto CDRs throughout the greater New Jersey area.
CDRs!
Oh,
wow!
Yeah. Back in the CDR day. And I couldn't afford the RWs. So you got to stick with the Rs. But I... I would say, I guess Paperback Bones, I made that in my apartment in New York after I graduated. So it was post being in school, but it was still like carrying all of those lessons with me.
In re-listening to all of your music that's available to stream for this episode, I was struck by the fact that even though it's very early and like your sound has matured a lot, sonically there are still some hallmarks of like what I would describe as like the Anthony D'Amato sound in that first-ish album. So like, what would you describe as like sonic hallmarks of your recordings?
Yeah, I am a big proponent of vocal doubling, and again, you know, that's a thing that I learned from just listening to my favorite songwriters and artists, and I think it was probably even something I took from listening to Bright Eyes Records and being like, oh, if your voice isn't like, you know, technically perfect and you're not technically right in the center of every note, mm-hmm. doubling your vocals can kind of cover that and add more energy. But I did this thing where when I first started recording, I was very naive about how recording software works and all that, and so I had a little M-Audio preamp and a little condenser mic, and you know, you plug in your XLR cable to one end to the condenser mic, and you plug it into mm-hmm. one of the two ports on the M-Audio preamp. It has like a left channel and a right channel for stereo recordings. And I would start recording, and I was like, okay, well, I want to make a stereo song. It's the 2000s. You got to be in stereo. We're not doing mono.
Got to. Absolutely got to.
And of course, because I had one microphone plugged into one channel, it would only come in on one side of the wave file. So I would just be recording left channel audio only. And I thought that meant something was like broken or I was doing it wrong, but I couldn't figure it out. So rather than, you know, actually like talk to someone and just realize like I should be recording these things in mono, or get another mic and record in stereo, I started recording stuff one channel at a time. So wow. I would record my left channel vocal, and then I would plug it into the right and record my right channel vocal. And I would do that with guitars and stuff. And, you know, sometimes I would just copy and paste the left channel into the right, which would make it sound like it was right down the middle. But a lot mm-hmm. of times I would double up. I would record left and right separately. And that became, I think... a hallmark of what you're hearing from that record, and then what I do now. Obviously, I'm not recording that way now, but I'm really into using up all of the sonic space from left to right. Panning really matters to mm-hmm. me, and making things feel really thick and lush in headphones really matters to me. I want you to feel like you're surrounded by the song and enveloped by it, and that probably started accidentally in those early days of not wow. understanding how to properly do it.
I will call this chapter of your life story, Cis Man Refuses to Ask for Directions,
yes.
inadvertently stumbles upon really solid recording technique.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't recommend it as a recording technique in general because, you know, while it does sound awesome on headphones, where you have those separate channels on speakers, it can get a little, and I, you know, it was among reasons I kind of let those very early things start to drift out. I feel like on Paperback Bones, I started to really get the hang of how to make that work in my benefit. But now I feel like I've come far enough that working with other producers and stuff, I am comfortable not double tracking my voice and just having one yeah. single live vocal take be the vocal and being able to accept that. And then being like, oh, that actually sounds pretty good. It doesn't sound like I'm trying to cover something up. You know, I think there's a time and a place for both. So on my new record, there's some that are double tracked and there's some that are just one raw vocal take. And
oh yeah,
I'm learning now how to figure out when, you know, that it doesn't have to be all one or the other and when it's appropriate.
I'm very excited to talk about this new album. But first, I have a couple more questions about those kind of early New York years.
Yeah.
Like the shipwreck from the shore days. That to me seemed like your breakout album. And what it came with was like, you'd been at it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You'd been writing, recording, and performing. But it seems like at that time, with that album, there was just an explosion in visibility. Like, literally more eyes and ears were on you. And knowing you as a friend, I know that you're shy and reserved at times. And so I wonder what it felt like in your body to be up on stages in front of so many new people. And part of why I'm curious about this is the song Middle Ground.
Yeah.
I always come back to that song, and I feel like it's such an interesting description of that time in your life, maybe, where the lyric says, I used to be alone, now I can't escape the crowd. Every night I go out looking for the middle ground. So can you talk about like that moment in your life?
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is that song, you know, predates any of that kind of stuff. That the shipwreck story was, I was about to start recording another album after Paperback Bones the same way that I thought I had been doing, you know, in the past. I was going to make it at home, do it myself. And then I kind of decided, you know, I know what this is going to sound like if I do that. I've done this before. I've been down this road.
Yeah.
I was working a day job at the time, and I was like, you know what? I've been saving up for something, and, you know, this is what it's going to be. I'm going to go make a record. I'm going to take this leap of faith. I'm going to put all my savings into going and making a record with a real producer in a real studio. And so I went and I recorded that up in Maine with Sam Kassir from Josh Ritter's band. Mm-hmm. And while, you know, we were probably about 80% of the way through recording, that was when the record label came in and decided to pick it up. And they hadn't even like heard it. They just heard the older stuff. And I was like, well, I'm in the mm-hmm. middle of making this new record. So by the time I signed a record deal and was able to leave my day job and be touring full time and all that kind of stuff, and having the press that you're talking about, the record had been done for like, you know, 6 or 8 months. So those songs weren't really about that so much as they were about, you know, coming out. I think it's probably an early 20s thing for everybody, but especially I feel like an early 20s thing, like, or mid 20s, whatever it was, coming out of a breakup where, you know, you kind of start ping-ponging a little bit between the extremes of like, okay, this long-term relationship I was in was just over, and now I'm gonna go out every night, and because I have no obligations, I have no ties, I'm just gonna go be, you know, single guy out in the world. And then you do that for a little bit and you're like, well, that's exhausting, you know. That's not really all that
that's expensive
cracked up to be. So now I'm going to be like hermit guy who's at home every day just working on music and writing and, you know, honing my craft or whatever you mm-hmm. tell yourself you're doing. And that's also exhausting in its own way and not super healthy. And so that song was just about trying to find that place where you can be, you know, not trying to fill every empty, quiet moment in your life with something, whether it's filling it with other people or filling it with, you know, work or whatever it is. It's about learning to sit still and be okay and say, you know what, I went out yesterday and that was a nice experience, and today I'm going to stay home and I'm going to find that middle ground where I don't just run myself into a big old fiery wreck.
How's that going?
You know, I think it's going pretty well for me these days.
I mean, you're on tour right now. I think it's hard to find a middle ground on tour.
For me, the middle ground, the way I've found my middle ground on tour is to bring my camera with me. I'm really into mm-hmm. photography. That's always been like a thing that I care about deeply. And for the first few times I went on tour, like especially going on tour in like England, and I would be opening up for somebody else and I might be like riding in their van with them and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I thought tour was like, it was cool, but it was also kind of depressing because it was like, I'm on somebody else's schedule and all I'm really seeing of this place that like you know, growing up, my parents didn't fly. So I never saw anything that you couldn't take a train to or drive to. And so I was like, all of a sudden, I'm in Europe. But I was like, it's gray, it's rainy, it gets dark at 3 p.m. And all I'm really seeing are like the venues and the hotels and the highway between them. And I had this idea of tour as just kind of like grim sort of experience, except for the shows. There were these highlights. And then I started to bring my good camera with me and travel on my own. Like, even if I was opening for somebody, I'd say, you know what, like, I'm going to figure out how to drive on the left side of the road in England. I'm going to, you know, eat the cost of renting this car, even though it's going into the, you know, the, whatever little profits I'm making. But I want to have my own experience of this place that I'm in. And that changed everything. Then touring became this incredibly rewarding, rich experience for me, because the shows were already the thing that I loved. But then it was like, every day was a reason to like get up at the crack of dawn and be like, okay, I'm driving 2 hours out of my way to this next show because I want to go see this crazy thing and go photograph it. Or I want to go do long exposure night photography of this thing with the stars. Mm-hmm. And so it was like, there wasn't enough hours in the day to do all the things mm-hmm. that I wanted to do and see all the things that I wanted to do on tour. And so that for me was the middle ground maker, I think, of tour, was to find a way to make it not all just green room, hotel, gas station, green room, hotel, gas station.
Oh, yeah. Okay, wow. Suddenly now I feel like I'm seeing your artistic journey out to Utah in a new light. Was the chance to photograph a part of what sent you out there to work on this new record?
You know, I can't say that was like a determining factor. For me, the determining factor was Joshua James, who produced mm-hmm. this record and is a songwriter that I'm just a humongous fan of. And we got paired up together for some shows in Sweden a while back and hit it off. And I just love the sound of his.
He's phenomenal.
He's great.
Oh, I'm wearing my Joshua James shirt.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah.
Shout out to Joshua.
Used to design. He, I think, hand stamped this back in the day.
Man, there are good people out there, and so I had this idea of going out to Utah and Joshua producing and him putting together the band of all local people, and me just kind of parachuting in and being like, "Here's the songs. Like, what would you do with them? Where would you take them?"
Right.
But that said, while I was out there, I absolutely, would get up in the morning and I would take, Joshua let me borrow the 15-passenger van he would tour in, and I would drive that around and go get photos. And one day his drummer, Timmy, took me up on the Alpine Loop there outside of American Fork to go do fall foliage photos and stuff. And I love that. And the cover of the new record is a Utah photo that I took on riding the California Zephyr across Utah, and it's shot out the window. So it's like one of those things where, you know, the cliffs in the distance look solid and steady, and the foreground is like this kind of blur of motion, and that kind of felt like what the record was to me. And that also led me to doing this thing where I'm sure you encounter this at shows where people are like, I don't have a CD player anymore. Like, my car doesn't play CDs. My computer doesn't play CDs. So with this album, I decided to, besides releasing it as, vinyl and CD, I also put it out as a book of my photographs from the road. And then the very last page of it has a card with a unique download code on it. So you open up the book and it's got these big full page photos and lyrics and an essay about the record and all that stuff. It's kind of like a visual companion for it. But you can download it, and that way you can listen even if you don't have a CD player in your car anymore.
What an interesting way to take in your art. I wish that more artists had sort of multimedia experiences, and it could be different for each one. Like, for you, it would be photographs. There are artists who I'd love to like have a recipe per song.
Yeah. Well, I think you're going to see a lot more of that in the coming years, because the CDs are just, they're becoming more and more obsolete, for better or for worse. And I've seen, I just saw an artist the other day who was selling their album as it was like a seed packet or something, QR code. So you like scan the QR code and you get the album on your phone, and then you put it in some soil and water it and stuff, and a plant grows out of it, you know?
That's amazing.
So I think you're going to see...
Coincidentally, that's what I want done with my body when I die.
That's what my wife, she wants to be a tree.
Who wouldn't want to be a tree?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know what I don't know what I want. I kind of like...
Better think fast.
I know. It's coming up. It's if I have to stay at the Econo Lodge much longer, it might
so
be today.
Sorry.
No, I totally get that. I understand the wanting to be a tree or something. I think regardless of what happens to me, I feel like one of the best tributes you see to people ever are like the benches with the plaque, you know, like in loving memory.
Oh, yeah.
If you have one of those, like a really scenic spot, you're like, man, that person must have been great, you know? You see one of those benches,
like,
and it's like
in a botanic garden,
yeah,
like,
or like
on, that's so
you know,
nice.
Overlooking the ocean on a cliff or something. But then you see some that are just like, you know, like by a brick wall in a dumpster, and you're like, that person must not have been very good.
I know, that would be a really nice way to like roast someone after their death.
Yeah, I'm sure someone has ironically dedicated a shitty bench.
Okay, so I want to talk about two songs on your new record, At First There Was Nothing. Okay, so Kind of Strange and Everything Does. To me, those songs both live in sort of the Greek tragedy world of fixed destiny, where kind of no matter where you move the pieces around at the beginning, they all puzzle together at the end towards this sort of inevitability. Do you live in that world as a person? Do you feel like there are things about our destiny that are completely out of our control?
I think so, but I don't necessarily think of it, especially a song like Kind of Strange, for instance, where that inevitability isn't necessarily coming from a like predestination, higher power, spiritual thing. To me, in that song in particular, the forces at play that are making the inevitable come true are they're more economic and political and racial, and they're mm-hmm. they're human constructs. And I think that's where I see the kind of you know, you talk about the pieces all ending up in the same place. Like, I think that is, you know, a place where I you can look at the way we've designed our society, and they're very much our pawns and kings and queens, and they can move in any direction that they want, but no matter how free you feel, you know, as that pawn figure or something, it's like there's really only mm-hmm. one direction you can go, and you can tell yourself that I'm choosing that, but if that's the only choice available to you, are you really choosing it?
I need to think about that for a minute.
Yeah, I'll go to the ice machine.
Oh, God. Stop reminding me that you're in the Econo Lodge. I hate that for you. People need to realize how unglamorous touring really is. Okay, so the song But I Go.
Uh-huh.
How did you build it? How would you describe for someone, like, the texture and sound of that song? And can you just, like, talk about the process of creating that texture?
So that was the song where we had pretty much recorded everything that I had come to the sessions with. And Joshua was like, I think we need one more song. Why don't we try to write one together from scratch? And so I had that fingerpicked lick that kind of is the anchor of the melodies. And Joshua had this chorus that he started doing. And I think, honestly, I think those lyrics were placeholder lyrics at first, that he just kind of was, because just to get a melody down. And I was like, one of those things where like, oh, what are you saying there? And he was saying, you know, I don't know where I go when I go, I don't know, but I go. And I was like, that actually kind of spoke to me in that way of, you know, we were talking about imagination and stuff before. And I don't know if you're a daydreamer the way that I am, but
big time.
Okay. So you'll have those moments where someone's just like, hey, you know, where'd you go? You there? Because you're sitting with them, but you're just like, you're somewhere completely else. And that, to me, that sparked this idea of being able to leave, you know, internally, like without going anywhere. And the beautiful, that can be a beautiful thing, and it can also be a sad thing. It can also be a scary, it can also be a disconnection thing. It can be a, you know, and that's how the song kind of shifts at the end. Like, it sort of goes from the, like, daydreaminess of I don't know where I go when I go to that very last verse where the vocal drops down, and the line is like, I didn't catch a thing. Was I here with you? Have I ever been? And that, yeah, that moment of like, man, thinking about like, have you been daydreaming your way through like an entire relationship or something, you know,
right,
where you're just like, oh, do I even know this person? Do they even know me? Or have I just been knowing like a projection of them that I created in my head, and that's who I've been with all this time or something, you know? Or have they been doing the
same
thing?
That is heavy. That's really heavy.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the song on the new Anais Mitchell record, The Words, where like it can be really lonely to be with somebody who's in their mind trying to find the words.
Yeah.
You should ask my boyfriend Cole about that.
Okay. Like, yeah.
Where'd you go just now?
Right.
Is like so common.
Yeah.
It's such a common conversation.
And I think it's, you know, and you're asking about the textures of that song. I think we were trying to, in some way, sort of capture that distance and that dreaminess of it. So there's pedal steel, and there's like multiple finger-picked guitars that are kind of layered on top of each other, and it's supposed to feel light and drifty, and then it gets kind of heavy and intense by the end, and the drums come in, and there's this kind of relentless kind of kick drum to it that just kind of powers it through, and until it eventually just kind of drifts into nothing. And there's even a moment too, which again, another accidental thing, where we originally thought that song was just going to be a fade out to end. And as Joshua was kind of pulling down the faders, he missed the piano or something. So basically all the instruments faded out, but the piano kept going through. And then, so we just faded them, all the instruments back in. And it made this moment again of that feeling of like, you know, when you kind of like snap back into it after you've been like, so all of the textures and sounds in that song, I think, you know, even if it was unintentional when we landed on it, all the things we kept about it were to serve that idea of kind of disappearing inside your own head.
That is such a cool journey into a song. This is your first album in 6 years, correct?
Yeah, it's the first full album I've released in 6 years. I would say we probably started recording this in like 2017, 2018.
Probably was
finished-ish. Well, I take that back, because I thought it was probably finished in 2018, 2019, and you figured we'd release it in 2020, and then obviously plans changed. But then I did go back into it during 2020 and maybe even 2021, and made some changes to stuff, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, and added a few textural things here and there. I redid my vocals on one song to change a few, you know, lyrical kind of things and stuff. So I brought in some other harmonies on stuff. So it's the first record I've released in 6 years, but the songs, you know, themselves were probably written not all that long after, you know, after Cold Snap, which was my second studio record.
It's such a beautiful album. It's already getting some very rave reviews, which I think are very well deserved. It's
Thank you.
Really interesting as someone that's followed your who's been listening to music for a while, since we've been buddies. This album feels like such an interesting homecoming for you. So I'm glad that you're coming on Basic Folk now with this record to talk about your journey.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I think you're right about that. It feels like a comfortable conversation to have with you about a record that I'm really proud and comfortable talking about in a way that sometimes I think previous records, either they, you know, the process of making it was like a really, difficult, stressful one or something, and I didn't know how to talk about it or this or that. And this one, it was just fun to make, and the songs are fun to play. And mm-hmm. I'm finding now that I'm starting to do press for it and stuff that they're fun to talk about, and it just feels,
yeah,
it feels good. So yeah, I think this is the right time.
Okay, before I let you go, yeah, I want to talk a little bit about Fantastic Cat.
Yes.
You are in a super group. Yes. This band is one of the most, a super group, one of the most fun live shows I've ever seen in my life.
Thank you.
If Fantastic Cat had a manifesto, what would it be?
You know, we have these very rude t-shirts that say Fantastic Cat, folk rock for pussies. And at this point, they've eclipsed any merch item I've ever done in my life. We are now a t-shirt that puts out records. That's primarily, okay, we're in the t-shirt business. But I do
congratulations
think,
on your entry into
thank you. We're in
clothing,
we're an apparel brand. But I do think folk rock for pussies is probably a pretty good mantra for us, because it, a couple of things. One, it, I hope, establishes right out of the gate that we don't take ourselves too seriously. That's one of those things where it's like, when people write about it, they use the word supergroup, which is like, yes, we're all in different projects and we're all coming together to form one thing, but it's also like none of us are famous or are stars in our own right. So it always feels like a little, I always feel like I have to put like super group in quotes, like when someone says something like that. So I feel like when we did the CBS, the morning show, the host introduced us as like a kind of super group. And I was like, that's it. That's what it is. We are
a kind of super
group. We are some kind of super group. But anyway, so I feel like the folk rock for pussies thing, I hope, lets people know that we don't take ourselves that seriously with it, and cut some of the pomp out of the, like, oh, it's four guys from four bands, you know. And obviously the comparisons to be made immediately are like, oh, Traveling Wilburys, you know.
Yep.
And it's like, oh, so you're comparing yourselves to Bob Dylan, George Harrison, Roy Orbison. So you can't, you know, you have to take some.
Who's
of the,
who? Who is who?
You know, that's the other thing. People will say like the Beatles, you know, thing, because we all sing and do all the harmonies and stuff, and they'll do the, oh, who's who, or they'll point at the cats. And I always say, I think it's four Ringos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sounds about right.
So folk rock for pussies, I think ideally takes some of the piss out of the seriousness that people, I think, assume you must bring to it if you are a super group. People, they can't see the video. I was doing air quotes with that.
Oh yeah, there were air quotes. Well, the cool thing about being a boy band super group is you don't have to, your band doesn't have to assert that everyone in your gender is worthy of singing, being a human being. If you're like an all-female super group, your super group has to carry the mantle of like your entire race, gender, identity, and
sure,
beliefs about the world.
And
but I think folk rock for pussies is a lot more fun.
Well, I also think, you know, if you're in a female super group, that word is attached to it. It's oh yeah, yeah, there, it's an all women super group. Or it's an all-women
band. Well, I like
band
to refer to any all-male bands or boy bands to me.
Yeah.
Like, and you're in a boy band.
Oh, I'm absolutely in a boy band. we say that all the time.
Because everyone sings.
But that's the thing, it's such a strange thing to feel, the things we feel like we have to put, like, a qualifier around. Yeah. Like, oh, it's a female band. And it's like, okay, so a band.
Yes, so a band.
Yeah, I'm familiar. People playing music together. Yeah, I've heard of that before.
I like to turn the focus back on all male groups, because I'm like, you don't know any women,
right?
You couldn't get even one in your band.
In our case,
something's
we
up.
Couldn't. No woman would spend the time with us. No, but we. That's my other thing too. Is I'll see, like, when they describe like a female singer songwriter as like a songstress.
And, kill me.
And you're like, okay.
Kill me. Trigger warning on this.
It's in.
Kill
it's,
me.
It's used in writing so much, but
I don't understand it.
But have you ever heard someone be like, oh yeah, I'm going to see my favorite songstress? Like, no one uses that word in conversation. And
because it's impossible to say, and it makes it sound like you're singing using your genitalia, which I find intriguing, but not necessarily palatable.
But I think at least on the flip side, then I would like to be referred to as a songster.
You got it.
As a male,
we have the power. I mean, we have the power here. Like I am the interviewer, and I write the intros.
The media elite.
So I can start calling you my favorite songster.
Your favorite that's in male a boy group. Songster.
Male songster.
We're here today on Basic Folk with male songster Anthony D'Amato. I think that has a nice ring to it. Yeah,
it does. We're changing the narrative. We're flipping the script. Okay, do you have time to do a lightning round before you get evicted from the Okono Lodge?
Yeah, I'm past checkout, but they don't seem to be super strict with anything here.
Wow. The life of luxury of a successful male songster. Okay. Lightning round is just a bunch of quick questions. First thing that comes to mind.
Yeah.
Okay. Jeans or sweatpants?
Jeans. Every day.
Sweet or savory snacks?
Sweet. I'm a chocolate man.
Hmm. Are you competitive?
Yes.
What is the best holiday?
Ooh, I'm a Thanksgiving fan.
What is your favorite New York restaurant?
You know, I still don't have a good answer for this one. But I will say, my wife and I, it was just our anniversary recently, and we were...
Happy anniversary!
Thank you. We were on a
Hi, Jane.
We were on a stroll in the West Village, and we stopped in this little Italian spot called Pece. And man, it was great. Old school Italian place, like 8 tables, old tin ceiling kind of thing, you know? And so I'm not going to say that's my favorite New York restaurant.
Ooh, this response has gone on too long for the lightning round. It's Pece.
It's my favorite kind of New York restaurant. An old,
I'm trying to crack down so future guests don't think they can go on and on explaining their reasoning, their background,
as a male,
qualifying their answers.
As a male songster, I believe I'm entitled to take as much time as I like.
Whose show are we on? Whose show are we on?
We're on
your
show.
What's your middle name?
Matthew.
Do you know any jokes?
Do I know any jokes? I've heard jokes before, yeah.
Can you tell us one now?
Why did the frog have to take the bus?
I don't know.
Because his car got towed.
Oh, that's cute.
There you go.
Okay, what's your favorite pasta shape?
Oh. I like anything that's got like a little corkscrew vibe to it, you know? It can be tight, can be loose.
And finally, is there sentient alien life out there?
Probably, yeah.
Anthony D'Amato, you are one of my favorite male songsters out there.
Possibly the only.
Yeah, and even though we got in a fight during this episode, I still think that you've been a fantastic guest,
Thank you.
I love your new album, At First There Was Nothing. Everybody go get that new record. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Basic Folk.
My pleasure.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by John Nungesser. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for us on the SiriusXM app under Basic Folk. You can check out our website, basicfolk.com, or find us wherever you get podcasts. Thanks for listening. Please feel free to share this episode with a friend, you know, because it's a nice thing to do, because, you know, thinking of people is a nice thing to do, and then acting upon that thought is also a nice thing to do. Regardless, we like it that you listened all the way to the end and you're hearing me talk about this stuff at the end, because it's the end of the podcast. It's the end of the podcast, so I'm going to wrap it up now. Okay, thanks for listening. Bye.